I've got other plans for you.
I can imagine.
You want to destroy me?
I have to. It's the only way to save Earth.
What if I granted you a kingdom?
You what?
Ming the Merciless, ruler of the universe, here and now, offers a kingdom of Mongol.
You're crazy. Why would you do that?
Because I've never before met your like. You're a hero. Don't you see that? Who better than you to rule the kingdom? Your moon is drifting very close now.
Earth's end might come within hours.
You'd call off the attack?
I could.
Everyone will be safe?
Yes.
Side and scattered into atoms.
Oh, welcome, welcome, my friends, to the song that never ends. I think that song was possibly a bit too long of an intro to actually start out with, but you'll have to let us know on that. So please give us your feedback, give us your stars. If you like this episode, write us the comments, give us a review, and post it up wherever you'll be listening to this podcast. It's available on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Anchor, and Castbox as well. So it's on quite a few platforms, so you'll definitely be able to tune in or wherever you may be and let us know what you think of us. So I think without much further ado, we should really get to the very nub of today's issues, which one of the topics I would like to talk about today in this very first podcast, which is going to be a bit of a potpourri of subjects rather than one long main subject, which we're going to get to in the next podcast, which is going to be the real, if you like, the first proper episode. And in that one, we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of the very issues that we like to discuss on this podcast, which is everything from true crime to the paranormal, 14 subjects, punk, conspiracy theories, and of course, plenty of cult films, which we'll be having a little section of cult films today. And we're not without our unusual and offbeat left field sense of humour, so that'll be making a little appearance later on. I won't tell you what's going to happen, but you'll have to keep listening to find out. Stay tuned. But meanwhile, back at Spahn Ranch, as the saying goes, really, what's happened to Brexit? Seems to have disappeared up a monkey's fundament, really. So far, it's been postponed and once, and it's been postponed twice, and it's been postponed thrice. Nay, nay, and thrice nay, Mr. Wilkes. So it's now, of course, been postponed as far as I'm aware, make of proceedings, and you're a better man than I am, Gunga Din, if you can really make a great sense of what really is happening down in the House of Parliament with regards to Brexit. It's postponed to the very auspicious date of Halloween, 31st of October, All Hallows Eve or All Hallows Harris, depending on your personal perspective of where you view the juncture of the space-time continuum from. It's a pretty bizarre one, and all the while we've got plenty of people who are wanting us to leave, and plenty of people who are wanting us to remain. And in amongst all the sort of, if you like, anarchy, the uncertainty, I was reading the other day that a couple of ordnance devices had actually been put on onto train tracks, believe it or not, in an attempt by a group person or persons unknown to derail the Brexit process, really. And of course, there isn't a day that goes by where you hear somebody's either sent death threats to some MP or, you know, wrote certain things on Twitter that, quite malicious things, really, in their sort of making their views about Brexit pretty clear about what we should and we shouldn't do. And, it's a very currently a hot potato. And I was reading only just funnily enough, as if, a coincidence should have it, a little while ago about what Yuri Geller had been trying to do with his psychic powers to stop the advance of Brexit. And of course, we could read a lot of things into what, Yuri Geller can do and can't do. You've got it on the one level, the face value level of what the media reports and would have us believe. And that's, the actual psychic powers that he supposedly does hold, which I'm open to all the theories under the sun as to whether that's true or not true. And then there's the other level, of course, where, he's been Israeli. Is there some secret intelligence work at foot? Is there a greater level of sort of malevolence, should we say, at foot? Is Mossad involved in this process about what he's supposedly been doing? But it's very interesting. We'll just get to that in a few seconds. We'll be just have a little jingle of music while I have a sip of my coffee. And we'll be right back with you, folks. So it's surprising what the sip of a nice, warming cup of coffee can do for the old noggin, the old seed pod upstairs. That's reinvigorated me a little bit more. So we're back really to Yuri Geller. What he did, it was the 22nd of May, when the supposed date, when he said he'd sent an open letter to the Prime Minister. Allegedly said he'd be using his formidable powers, which, quote-unquote, have been validated by the CIA, MI5 and Mossad. So there we go, there you have it, from the officials themselves, straight from the MK Ultra's mouth. And the actual article says, he says, I feel psychically and very strongly that most British people do not want Brexit. I love you very much, but I will not allow you to lead Britain into Brexit. As much as I admire you, I will stop you telepathically from doing this. And believe me, I am capable of executing it. Before I take this drastic course of action, I appeal to you to stop the process immediately while you still have a chance. Although I currently live in Israel, I am a British citizen and feel very passionately about the country and the people I came to love. And interestingly enough, the article also goes on to state, now this is where it does get very murky, the water's started to get very shark infested. Too many sharks in the gene pool, perhaps. He said, Yuri also claims to have focused his energies on ensuring that Jeremy Corbyn never gets the keys to number 10 Downing Street. Now, yeah, that's a very, very interesting sort of supposition or proposition, whichever way you sort of take the needle to bend over on the old coup-cometer. Believe you me, I think it's cooking pretty highly now on that little nugget of information. That's pretty sinister, that is, really. Oh, yeah, that's got my my old grey matter, little grey cells, as Poirot said. They're doing overtime on that one. And he said, I'll ensure that the keys to number 10 bend out of all proportion to ensure that he never takes up residence there. So he's actually going to use his, telekinesis, if you like, his mental powers to actually ensure that the keys themselves wilt on. Under the auspicious event, should it ever occur that Mr. Corbyn tries to get into number 10, he won't be able to because he'll be firmly locked out. And then the latter part of the article states that, as regards to, I wasn't aware of this at all, actually, I have to say, leaking pipes in the House of Commons, and apparently that actually caused a suspension of Brexit. And of course, you can read the, water. Into Watergate and a tap at the door and all the rest of it. Funny man, Howard E. Hunt was. He certainly wasn't a plumber. But then Yuri again says, I said earlier in my open letter that I will think you... I'll read that again, sorry. I said earlier in my open letter that I think you all need sacking. Well, I can't sack you, but at least I can soak you. So there's some humour there from Mr. Geller as well. That's quite an interesting little twist on the old Brexit business, really. That's certainly, it's very interesting. That's, the way that that's would have been proposed, that it may be, via that sort of medium, that far greater forces are at work than Mr. Geller on having a say who's actually going to have the keys to the parliament. It might just be a little bit of a hidden world. Say like a little bit of look at the wiring under the floorboards there a little bit to see who really is running the show. Yeah, very most interesting that one, definitely, absolutely. Pretty. I'd say on the scale of 1 to 10, it's a surefire 10. So I said we were going to do one or two left field moments, particularly regards our sense of humour. At Cooking HQ here, and I've got a joke coming up for you, and I certainly hope that the next gentleman that I'm going to introduce has got a joke coming up for you. But as this is going to be live and unscripted and unrehearsed, anything could happen in a few minutes, so prepare yourselves for that one. Hang on, fasten your seatbelt, it's going to be one hell of a ride. Well, here's my joke. It's a bit of an old one, but it's an oldie but a goldie. And you can't beat the old ones, as the Marquis de Sade said, he was whipping the pensioner. Sorry. Oh dear, that's terrible. How many Zen Buddhists does it take to change a light bulb? It's two. One to change it and one to see it was already all right the way it was. So, there in a nutshell may be something about Brexit itself, really. That's there ends today's lesson. And now, in a few minutes, we hope to go live with our update, and it's going to be a special entitled section. It's going to be called Joke of the Podcast. So without further ado, let's get straight over there. Here we go. Begin it up. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4. Here he is, the man of the moment, putting you over to Jack for joke of the podcast.
Which cheese rules the world? Halloumi, not I.
Of course, going back to the Uri Geller article, I wonder if that date was actually correct. That was on the 22nd of May, unless it was the 22nd of May last year. I wonder if it was supposed to be reading the 22nd of March, maybe. Not sure on that one, really. It's interesting, though. I've only just that sort of twigged in the old grey matter. That date can't be right, unless, of course, we're referring to last year. But it's and the actual news has only just come to light, which makes it quite interesting that all of a sudden it's been thrust into the limelight. And why has that been thrust into the limelight, which makes it quite bizarre, really, to say the least. Anyway, now we're going to talk exclusively in a minute or two. At the time when I started up doing this podcast, it was probably the hot topic, apart from Brexit, because Brexit was sort of going into its final negotiation stages. And then, of course, like I said, it's got delayed and it's got delayed again. And currently it seems to be off topic and slightly out of the news now. But at the time, it was, of course, a sad day. It was the New Zealand Moss Massacre. When I going to talk, you know, a little bit about that and what we think about that, you know, the sort of bizarreness of all these, you know, planned terror attacks, and what the real reasoning behind some of these attacks could actually be. Could there be a far more sinister degree of nature at force? Or is it just simply and sadly, you know, sort of xenophobia, really, the baser instincts of people that have come to the fore? And really, I mean, for one moment, you know, we don't condone this. We think it's absolutely appalling, you know, what actually happened and what took place. But it's always worthy of interest, these articles, you know, these news, when the actual crimes happen, you know, why are they happening? Why are they happening at that particular point, in that particular juncture in time? So we're going to look at that, you know, in a good thorough investigation, put that under the microscope and see what we can see. Then we're going to do every podcast, we'll have drink of the podcast. So that's going to be coming up fairly shortly. Then we've got an interesting sort of subsection about climate change and climate change denial. And that's pretty hot topic in the news with all the climate change protests. There's been one or two climate change protests from schools, you know, schools going on, pupils going on strike, pupils going to protest about climate change. We're going to talk about a little bit about climate change denial. We're going to talk about sort of about the green movement in itself. Then we're going to go on to a bit of music, which will be coming up. We'll always have one or two pieces of music, at least one piece of music in each podcast. Then we've got something that I didn't really know about and I was totally unaware of, and it's the Poland Xanax poisoning weirdness, with a key conspiracy researcher died in pretty mysterious circumstances. As much as he lived his life in fairly unusual circumstances, the manner of death was absolutely bizarre, really. I mean, there may be a logical explanation, but I can't help thinking that the whole nature of the scenario itself and the way it ended up is utterly bizarre. And then we'll be doing our book of the month, or book of the podcast, if you like. I've actually finished the book now. And it's a classic book on hauntology. So we'll be discussing hauntology. And our film of the podcast is Arcadia, which at the current time of doing this podcast was still available on BBC iPlayer for free. And I think most people probably got access to the iPlayer. If it's still there, I really recommend wholeheartedly that you go out and check out that, download the Arcadia film, put a good nearly an hour and 20 minutes to one side. Get yourself a drink if that's your persuasion, and just, you know, really get into the meat and potatoes of that, because that's got a lot to say. That's a superb piece of film. It's possibly, I think left field's the wrong word for it. It's a very, very it's a subtle piece of film, and then it's pretty didactic. It builds up like sort of an enormous sort of tremor. You can feel it coming, and then the rush of the energy of the tremor comes. It sort of hits you with its full force right at the end, square between the eyes, and it leaves you reeling. So I like things that do like that. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love the Hollywood blockbusters and all the rest of it. But, I mean, you go away and sometimes all those films are all gong and no dinner. You know, they're after the Lord's Mayor's show, aren't they? They're all gravy boat, as people have said before. But with things like that, you really get... they're the meat and potatoes of stuff, aren't they? You know, it's a good hearty stew. It really makes you think. And I think that's what, you know, either media or film, books... they should always make you think as well. If they're going to have, you know, some underlying message, there should always be a far greater message in the awaiting in the wings, if you like. So we'll be discussing all that. So that's pretty much what most of this podcast is going to be about. So we're going to get straight, after a bit of a commercial break, we're going to get straight back into the nub of the issue, and we're going to be straight to the New Zealand Mosque Massacre, which, as I say, at the time of doing this podcast, at the very beginning of its... nascent birthing, if you like. It was hot news. It was hot topic. It had just happened. But that's obviously a little while ago. And some of you may be aware of some of the facts. Others might not be aware of the facts. And we're going to deal in the facts first of all. And then we're just going to have a little bit of an overview, a little bit of a spin on it, and look at one or two sort of theories that are out there as well, and see what they have to say, and maybe draw a few conclusions of our own at the end of it. So that's all coming up. Right after this commercial break. And here's a word from our sponsors. Oh dear, oh dear, I think I'm still laughing about the Illuminati joke. Jesus Christ, come on down. That was brilliant. Thank you, Jack. So he'll be making a fairly regular guest appearance on every podcast. So that's something to mark in your diaries and to look forward to. And I think that was absolutely brilliant. And maybe, you know, in the future, when we get merchandise sorted, maybe we should have to have that on a T-shirt. Yeah, Jesus Christ, here comes the Illuminati. Could be a bit like the Spanish Inquisition. You never suspect the Spanish Inquisition, and you never suspect the Halluminati. Maybe something like that, yeah. So along those lines, I think that'd be absolutely pitch perfect. So now we're going to get straight into the nub of the issue, which is about the New Zealand mosque massacre. Without further ado, well, we're going to present the facts of that. First of all, before we get down into one or two different theories, we're going to go straight for the hardline facts. Oh, so we're back. I'm still got it in my brain a little bit about the Illuminati, and was thinking... I always wondered why cheese came in the shape of a triangle. So now really you ought to really call it Dairy Lee Eye in the Triangle cheese, perhaps. Rename that a bit. And that explains that one a little bit to me. I've always been perplexed by that. So we are going to get straight on to something a lot more serious now as we come to talk about the Christchurch mosque shootings, which is probably the main core topic of this potpourri podcast, where for once we're covering a number of topics rather than just one solid topic, which we'll be doing from next podcast. And I'll leave details of the next podcast at the end of this podcast as a spoiler to let you know what to expect, and put a pencil, a date in your diaries for when that's out. So stay tuned. But I'd like to get on to the key facts, first of all, before we get on to any theories about the New Zealand massacre. So the New Zealand massacre itself, the Christchurch massacre, the mosque shootings, were two consecutive terrorist attacks at mosques on Christchurch, New Zealand, during Friday prayer on the 15th of March 2009. And that was, as I said, that was initially when this podcast should have been aired. It was around that time that I was actually going to do a podcast. So it was at that particular time, it was very, very fresh news. The attacks began at the Al Noor Mosque, I beg your pardon on my pronunciations here, or enunciations. They may be not entirely correct. So feel free to send your bouquets or your brickbats to the usual address. In the suburb of Riccarton at 1:40 p.m. and continued at the Linwood Islamic Centre at about 1:55 p.m. And this is one of the first key things that puzzled me about the attacks, was the fact that the gunman live streamed the first attack on Facebook Live. So that's, as far as I'm aware, that might have been a first for these kind of attacks, that someone's actually decided to use, you know, social media for whatever reason you may take to sort of accentuate this, if you like, in a way probably perhaps to elevate the attacks, or perhaps a way to highlight the attacks even further. But that was the first thing that struck me as very, very puzzling about these attacks. The attacks killed 50 people and injured 50 more. It was a 28-year-old Australian man, described by the media as a white supremacist and part of the alt-right movement, who was arrested and charged with the murder of the 50 people and, of course, the injuring of 50 other individuals. It is the deadliest shooting in New Zealand's history. And we'll just, before we'll go into key things in little bits and stages here, in case anybody is new to these topics, which of course some people are very, maybe, you know, dyed in the wool, if you like. They may know all about, there is to know about, say, conspiracy theories and these sort of subject matters, but also we'll explain, you know, certain terms in case you're actually just new to this subject. And you just come in, you know, straight off the bat, if you like. So white supremacy, that's the racist belief that white people are superior to people of other races and should therefore dominate them. That's just a bit of an overview. I mean, most people probably know what white supremacy is generally taken to mean, but that's in case anybody was a bit puzzled by that particular one. And I'm going to explain a little bit. This is something that's a fairly relatively new term that's been bandied about by the media. It's a soundbite, if you like, much like the war on terror was a media soundbite. The alt-right is another one of their soundbites. So the alt-right, or the alternative right, is a loosely connected far-right white nationalist movement. It comes under many banners and many forms. And it's from the American white nationalist Richard B. Spencer, who launched the alternative right webzine to disseminate his ideas. So that's where the name kind of came from, and it kind of, you know, it's disseminated further into the media, and it's been in the news quite a bit with alt-right Donald Trump supporters showing various, you know, slogans and placards and basically, you know, waving those around. So it's come more into the fore, that particular term. So going back to the massacre, the first shooting since, again, I'm not sure how I pronounce this, Ramaro Massacre of 1997. So this was the first mass shooting since that particular one, where Stephen Anderson killed 6 and wounded 4 with a sawn-off single-barrel shotgun. He was found not guilty of murder by reason of insanity. But prior to that, the deadliest mass shooting was the 1990 Aramoara Massacre. Again, I beg you my pardon about the pronunciations and the enunciations here. And that was by resident David Gray, who killed 13 people after a verbal dispute with his next-door neighbour. So that's just a little bit of a background on New Zealand. There has been massacres before in New Zealand, but nothing on this scale. As I say, it's now the deadliest mass shooting, sadly, to occur in New Zealand. Australia, where the gunman is from, because he's not a native New Zealander, I've seen a recent increase in xenophobia and racism and Islamophobia. So that's, and I think, sadly, that's been the case, you know, generally around. I've noticed that when people are sort of using Brexit as an excuse to peddle, you know, Islamophobic filth, basically. And we, of course, we, you know, we do totally condone these attacks here at Cooking Central. We don't stand with these attacks whatsoever, and we're completely against, you know, all that type of, you know, right-wing hatred. The Al Noor Mosque was the first mosque on the South Island, and it opened in 1985. The Linwood Exarmic Centre opened in early 2018. So just a bit of an overview there of when those particular mosques came into being, really. And now back to the shooting itself. The gunman began shooting worshippers at the Al-Noor Mosque first at around about 1:40 p.m. Between 300 and 500 people may have been inside the mosque on Friday prayer at the time of the shooting, so it was pretty packed, that mosque, on that particular day. And here's a little bit about the live streaming. The gunman live streamed the first 17 minutes of the attack on Facebook Live, starting with driving to the mosque and ending with driving away from the mosque. And moments, this is also bizarrely a little bit of a snippet I actually saw through one of the news media outlets at the time, before I was going to work, when I, you know, heard of the attack. It showed a chap getting into a car and moments before the shooting, and he was playing several songs, including it was a military march of some description that I heard on the particular piece of footage that I'd seen. And that was a march by the British Grenadiers, a traditional marching song, and also played, which I didn't hear on this particular snippet, it was a Serbia Strong, a Serb national anthem song celebrating Radovan Karadzic, who was found guilty of genocide against Bosnian Muslims. One witness said the gunman continued to play military music from a portable speaker inside the mosque. And that's an interesting little fact I didn't know there. So I don't know whether he had some kind of Bluetooth speaker hooked up, or, you know, what the reasoning for that was, but that's also fairly bizarre. As he approached the front entrance, he was greeted with "Hello, brother," by a worshipper. He was one of the first victims, sadly, to be killed in the attacks. The gunman spent several minutes inside the mosque, shooting attendees indiscriminately. A strobe light attached to one of his weapons was used to disorientate the victims. Now, I've never, ever come across hearing that employed in these sort of situations before. So I wonder, you know, again, that's also slightly bizarre. I didn't know that fact either. Slightly bizarre fact of the case there as well. He eventually left the mosque to obtain another weapon. Then he returned again to the mosque to kill more victims, many of whom were already wounded and unable to escape. He exited the mosque again and killed a woman near the footpath as she pleaded for help. He left the scene shortly after in his car to the music of "Fire" by The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, which again is another bizarre thing to have playing, because of course the singer proclaims, "I am the god of hellfire," partway through that song. So that's pretty bizarre. And altogether, he spent about 6 minutes inside the Al-Noor Mosque. He shot several of the civilians in the area before he headed to the Linwood Islamic Centre, and the second attack began roughly at 1:55 p.m. It is a mosque 3 miles east of the Al-Noor Mosque. According to a witness, the gunman did not find the mosque's main door and shot people outside and through a window, alerting those inside. So that in this particular case, he wasn't able to somehow, for some reason, to be able to get, you know, inside the mosque. And in doing so, he decided to resort to actually shooting through the window at various people who are worshipping inside. The mosque acting imam credited worshipper, and again, I'm afraid my pronunciation is not very good with this gentleman's name, Abdul Aziz Wadabzada, with stopping the attack. And this is quite an interesting little snippet as well. Abdul told reporters he took a credit card reader and ran out of the mosque, by which time the attacker had already shot several people. The attacker went to retrieve another gun from his car, so Abdul threw the card reader at him. The gunman took the rifle and fired at Abdul, who took cover among nearby cars and retrieved an empty shotgun the gunman had dropped. Then Abdul attempted to draw the gunman's fire by declaring, "I'm here," but the gunman entered the mosque and continued firing. When the gunman returned, Abdul threw the shotgun at his car windscreen, shattering it. The gunman then drove away. So he was actually credited by the imam of the mosque, the Linwood Islamic Centre, of actually, you know, he probably stopped a lot more of the massacre happening by bravely, you know, fighting back, basically, with what he got to hand. The gunman was then arrested on Broham Street in Sydenham some 21 minutes after the first emergency call, his car had been rammed against the curb by a police car before his arrest at gunpoint. It came to light, I think via the Prime Minister and the intelligence services and the police, that the suspect had actually been planning a third attack, so he was stopped from doing that, because there were two other firearms in the vehicle that the offender was in. So he was on the way to somewhere else to carry out more of an attack, and he was actually stopped from doing that. Overall, 50 people died in the attack, 46 male and 4 female, 42 at the Al Noor Mosque and 7 at the Linwood Islamic Centre, and one who sadly later died in a Christchurch hospital. 50 people had been injured in the attacks, and the suspect himself was Brenton Harrison Tarrant, a 28-year-old Australian man. And this is a little bit of a background about Tarrant himself. Around 2012, he started visiting a number of countries in Asia and Europe. So that's quite an interesting fact there itself. It said police in Bulgaria and Turkey are investigating their visits to their nations. He became obsessed with terrorist acts committed by Islamic extremists in 2016 and 2017 and started planning an attack about 2 years prior to the shootings. So some planning in these attacks. Security officials suspect he came into contact with far-right organisations about 2 years before the shootings while visiting European nations. Now, here's a few interesting little nuggets that I didn't know that got the old coup-cometer cooking. He donated €1,500 to Identitaire Bewung Aufrechts, the Austrian branch of the Identitarian movement. So apologies about my pronunciation again there. The Identitarian movement, for those who I was completely unaware, this is a far-right and white nationalist movement that started in France. And he also donated €2,200 to the French branch of this group, so that was possibly the original branch of the group. So that's a fair sum of money there. He's probably, you know, overall, it's €3,700. So we're roughly talking probably about $3,500, aren't we, really, donated to those two groups. Well, that's very interesting in itself as well. He was also captivated with the sights of the battles between the Christians and the Ottoman Empire, which the Ottoman Empire is the Turkish Empire. He went on a series of visits to the Balkans between 2016 and 2018 with Croatia, Bulgaria, Hungary, Turkey and Bosnia-Herzegovina being the main places he decided to visit. Police recovered 5 guns from the scene, all on a firearms licence, so they're all legally held, these guns. There were 2 semi-automatics, 2 shotguns and a lever-action firearm. Additionally, he illegally replaced the semi-automatic rifle's small legal magazines with 30-round magazines. These were also legally purchased online. So he had a bit of knowledge about what to do with guns, you know, the making of the actual reloading of the guns. And, of course, he modified these guns to make them hold a greater number. And, of course, they became, in essence, when he modified them, actually illegal to possess them. And this was very interesting. It's something I noticed on the video that it was around at the time, at the beginning of the morning, when the attacks and the news had broke. I noticed what I thought was writing on his guns. I thought, that's actually white writing, whether it was in chalk or paint. I thought, what's he actually written on his guns? That's absolutely bizarre. And the guns and magazines were covered in white writing, naming historical events and people and motives related to historical conflicts, wars and battles between Muslims and European Christians, as well as the names of recent Islamic terror attack victims and the names of far-right attackers. So plenty of interesting nuggets of information there. Right? You can draw your own conclusions from that one. The markings also included references to, I'm afraid I'm not sure how to pronounce this either, Turkophagos, which means Turk eater, a term used by the Greeks during the Greek War of Independence. And now the Greek War of Independence was a successful war waged by Greek revolutionaries against the Ottoman Empire between 1821 and 1830. And if I believe correctly, and we haven't got time to go into it in this particular podcast, I think the British and various other countries had some, you know, influence, i.e. helped the Greeks in their war of independence against the Turks. So that's also a bit interesting. White supremacist slogans such as the anti-Muslim phrase "Remove Kebab," that's that particular phrase, which I was unaware of, originated from the Serbia, and the 14 words, and we'll get to those in a second. "Remove Kebab" is a meme and slogan derived from a Serbian nationalist anti-Muslim propaganda music video from the Yugoslav wars. So I was unaware of what that particular slogan and where that came from. I was vaguely aware of what the 14 words were, or often written 14888. It's a reference to the 14-word slogan, and there's one of two slogans it could be referenced to. More often it's a reference to, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children." Or less commonly used, "Is because the beauty of the white Aryan woman must not perish from the earth." And that was originally coined by white supremacist David Lane. And I think he was, although we haven't got time to go into it today, I think he was part of a group called The Order, a far-right group, or he founded a far-right group called The Order, and he was an American white supremacist. There was also the Latin alphabet, writings on the weaponry were in, again, were in, also in Cyrillic, Armenian and Georgian alphabet. So some unusual things written on these weaponry, really, quite bizarre things, really. On his pack was a black sun patch and two dog tags, one with a Celtic cross and one with a Slavic swastika design. So again, some bizarre motifs and symbols, you know, being used on these particular things. In the black sun itself is a symbol employed in post-Nazi Germany context by neo-Nazis and some occult subcultures. So I mean, that we'd have to get into an old entire new episode just discussing the black sun there, and one day I hope we might come to discuss that, but that's also pretty bizarre. Another nugget of information I didn't know anything about: the police also find improvised explosive devices attached to the car. These were diffused by the New Zealand Defence Force. Tarrant is allegedly the author of a 73-page manifesto entitled The Great Replacement, a reference to the Great Replacement and white genocide conspiracy theories. And we'll just go into briefly about what the Great Replacement actually means, very, very briefly. The Great Replacement is a nationalist far-right wing conspiracy theory which states that the white Catholic French population, as well as white Christian European population at large, is being progressively replaced with non-European people, specifically Arab, Berber, Middle Eastern, North African and Sub-Saharan populations. So that's, you know, that's also pretty bizarre. The manifesto was emailed to more than 30 recipients, including the Prime Minister's office and several media outlets, and links, including Twitter and 8chan, which of course has been a bit of a forum for that type of, you know, right-wing sort of ideology, if you like. The manifesto displays symbols such as the black sun once again and Odin's cross. Bizarrely enough, although the author denies being a Nazi, instead describing himself as an ethno-nationalist, an eco-fascist and a kebab removalist. And we're just going to explain a few of those terms here, again, very, very briefly. So we haven't got time, really, sadly, to go into a big in-depth, you know, discussion about it. Ethno-nationalist is a form of nationalism where the nation is defined in terms of ethnicity. And eco-fascism is a theoretical political model in which a totalitarian government would require individuals to sacrifice their own interests to the organic whole of nature, and which would rely on militarism, expansionism and possibly racism to defend the land. And then, interestingly enough, again, when I heard this, I thought, that's very bizarre. The author cited Anders Behring Breivik and others as being his inspiration. There was also a bit of talk, which we will get to in a little bit. We haven't got time to go into it expressly and fully, that he had been in correspondence with Breivik, but we'll get into that in a few minutes. His reasons for carrying out the mass shootings included his intent to drive a wedge between the nations of NATO, that a European and the Turks would also make a part of the NATO Union. So that was interesting as well, a very interesting nugget. On 23rd of March 2019, the manifesto was deemed objectionable by the Chief Censor of New Zealand, making it unlawful from that date to possess or distributed it in New Zealand itself. So that's also interesting. Not that I'm saying that people, you know, that should be freely distributed about. That was an interesting thing itself. In court, he smiled at reporters and made an inverted OK gesture below his waist, said to be a white power sign. We'll briefly look into what that might mean when we get to the theory side of it in a few minutes. The United Kingdom's Domestic Intelligence Service, MI5, launched an inquiry into the gunman's possible links to the British far right, which was something I didn't know. And I've heard this fairly recently, so I've tied this in because this is, again, this is a sad thing that's happened over the Easter holiday period, the Sri Lankan Easter bombings. I think it might have been the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka, don't quote me on that, who thought or said there were retaliation for the Christchurch mosque attacks, or possibly could have been a retaliation for the Christchurch mosque attacks. However, analysts believe these attacks to have been planned before the Christchurch attacks, so more than likely they've nothing to do with it. And as regards the actual Facebook film itself, the uploaded footage of the beginning at the Elnor Mosque, the massacre, the 17-minute footage, the New Zealand Office of Film and Literature classified the live-streamed attack as objectionable, making it an offence to distribute, copy or exhibit the video, with potential penalties of up to 14 years in prison. And one or two people, I think in New Zealand, and I think maybe in the world, not too sure on that one, certainly New Zealand, have actually got charged with the offence of possessing and distributing that particular film. So that's also a pretty interesting thing. And of course, just before carrying out the attacks, the gunman said to the camera, "Remember, lads, to subscribe to PewDiePie," referring to YouTuber Felix Kjelberg, and I'm not sure if I pronounced that last bit of his name right, but the apparent intent as of that, again, as of the intent of doing a Facebook Live video, was to get the manifesto spread to the news of the attacks to the millions of PewDiePie's followers. And in response, PewDiePie tweeted not long after, "Just heard the news about the devastating attacks in Christchurch, New Zealand. I feel absolutely sickened having my name uttered by this person. My heart and thoughts go out to the victims, families and everyone affected by this tragedy." So obviously he denounced that, that he'd actually tagged him in that, which again, that was also another bizarre thing, almost piggybacking him, using his name to get that sort of message across, or if you like, or to try and get, you know, as many people to witness these massacres and attacks that he's carried out. So that's all the facts there, in a, you know, a very condensed nutshell version. And now what we're going to do is we're actually in a few minutes we're going to have a little break now, and then we're going to get into one or two theories. So stay tuned. We'll be back fairly shortly. Thank you for listening. Wella, wella, wella. It's almost time for Sideways and Bedways, my little droogs, as we're coming to the end of this podcast. And I hope you've enjoyed this first Ultimate Horror Show. And if you've enjoyed it, you know what to do. Leave us a nice review. And if you haven't enjoyed it, leave us an equally horrific review. Make sure you publicise us and put us in all those places we all really want to be. Speaking about, before we get on to the subject of the next, which we're going to go into the theories about the New Zealand massacre, before we do, one of my colleagues brought it to my erstwhile attention, I think it was a couple of days ago, that, and it's about the subject of Brexit, which we've discussed in brief, really, for this opening salvo into the world of podcasting, which we've now dipped our toes and fully got wet under azure blue skies. They mentioned there's actually a film out there, something I didn't know, honestly, viewers and listeners. I had no idea about this film, so please don't judge me. Apparently it's a hardcore porn film called Hard Brexit. And in this particular film, there's characters like Theresa May Not, there's Tronald Dump, there's Nicholas Virgin, and there's Jizza Quorbin. Ha ha ha. Or is it Forbin? Might be Jizza Forbin, more than likely. And apparently the main sort of plot of the, if you like, of the actual entirety of the film itself, if you can call it a film, it's obviously a parody, is that Donald Trump and Theresa May Not as the case may be, end up having engaging in a little bit of rumpy pumpy. And to be honest with me, that thought really has put me off my 11s. I just thought I'd share that one with you, really. Just throw it out there. I just can't get it out of my head, to quote the song. And maybe he couldn't get it out of his either. Yeah, that was terrible. Sorry. So meanwhile, back with the show. We'll be back shortly, right after this commercial break, with the theories. Stay tuned. Cheers, everyone. That's really hit the spot on this very, very windy, stormy, rain-swept night. There's nothing like curling up with a bit of a cooking podcast and one of your favourite beers and settling down whilst I chew the breeze and chew the fat and see if we can get to the very, meat and potatoes of the theories surrounding the New Zealand massacre. And the first thing that struck me, which was very apparent from the start when I did a little bit of research into this, after, like I say, my mind, sort of my curiosity being piqued by some of the bizarre aspects of the case, was that actually online there was very, very little being said in the way of, conspiracy theories, alternative sort of timelines and alternative ideas about the narrative of the events of that particular day in New Zealand. And I found that quite odd, because generally when most sort of big world events happen, the first thing, within seconds, minutes of these happening, someone somewhere has posted out, an alternative timeline, alternative theory, rightly or wrongly. And let me just state, these are not my theories, first of all. And I must strongly, say to you, dear listeners, that you must do your own research, come up with your own ideas and look into the nuts and bolts and the little crannies and nooks and the facades of these stories. So that's what we want to do, what the podcast is all about. It's really looking under the floorboards, looking at the wiring of things, see how things are wired together, sort of looking behind the curtain and seeing what's really there. Guess who's running the show, really? I want you to, to do your own research and not take me, ad verbatim, what I say. These are not my theories, I must stress that. There's one or two theories that I did eventually find out there, and there's not many. But before we go into theories, I'd just like to point out when people ask you, about conspiracies, I'd like to just point out, first of all, the definition of the word conspiracy. And it's a secret plan by a group to do something unlawful or harmful. So even if you accept this is going slightly away from this subject, but suppose, people come up against you and say, 9/11, that's not a conspiracy theory. Well, actually, it is a conspiracy theory, because even if you accept the official narrative about the people who wanted to blow up the World Trade Center and the Twin Towers, they will have conspired a secret plan, a group of them, to do something unlawful or harmful. So it actually is a conspiracy. So that's the kind of irony of, something that is out there. That's the first thing to point out. Before we get any further into this subject matter, and one of the things I was reading a little about was about the manifesto, which is a 239-page account, which is a big tract, a fair chunk of, manner, if you like, from Brenton Tarrant's mind. He's a logical mind. And it actually starts out, somebody made a little point that I was reading about, an unusual poem to the hammers of rage, and to the old gods of the Norse. And I wonder if that was perhaps edifying out Thor's Ten Hammers itself. That's what I first came to wonder. And as far as I'm aware, I mean, I could be wrong, and you can correct me on this. I'll be like the man with orthopedic shoes. I'll stand corrected. I'm sorry. I think Thor's Ten Hammers are actually the swastika. is actually the, you know, the original form of the swastika. And of course, the swastika can be placed on different sort of alignments as to whether it's good or evil. But that sort of sprung to my mind when they were discussing this. And it seemed to state in these theories that I read online that the original manifesto, which was sent out to the media outlets, was actually a decoy. And the real manifesto, you could only obtain that if you followed the encrypted clues within the fake manifesto, which would then open up the original and the real manifesto. So I'm not sure if there's two manifestos out there, whether that's just an actual in-joke, because a lot of the things that are said in the manifesto, as it appears to be in what I've read online, it's like he's interviewing himself, and it almost seems paradoxical in nature, and it attempts to go, it sort of laments its self-parody eventually. It's particularly about video games and a lot of mentions about the Sega Master System, which, again, it's more than bizarre, if you ask me, really. It's either, you know, a bit of sort of black humour being thrown in there, or it's designed to lead us off probably what's really being said, or is there some kind of hidden message within those communications? I guess that's something for another time. We're not going to have enough time to get into the very nuts and bolts of that today. And one of the other things this was on a different sort of site that I came across, a couple of theories we're just going to run through very quickly here. It was the time span issue. Now, the first attack started at 1:40 p.m., according to sources. He spent 6 minutes at the Al-Noor Mosque. He then shot some civilians as he came out and drove to the Linwood Mosque. The second attack began at 1:55 p.m., and the Linwood Mosque is 3 miles east of the Al-Noor Mosque. So I wasn't sure what this particular individual was driving at, because really that still allows the time difference, you know, apart from if it's very bad with traffic, to get to both of those places, I would imagine. The only conclusion that if the time differences don't add up, and there isn't any evidence to support this, of course, is that there could have been a second shooter, and whether somebody was driving at this, that there was a second shooter. Of course, the initial foray and anarchy that reigned after the shootings, several other people were arrested, but these people were, of course, released, as far as I'm aware, without charge. So there was talk of a second shooter originally, but then that theory was discredited and discounted. So whether this person is actually trying to state is that it was a second shooter, that's the only thing I can think that they're driving at, but I'm not sure I buy that one myself, really. The other thing that, of course, and I did a twig on this at the time, was that, according to some sources, which were revealed in the manifesto, Brenton Tarrant claimed to have been in brief contact with Norwegian terrorist Anders Breivik. And of course, Breivik was the Norwegian far-right terrorist who committed the 2011 Norway attacks and murdered 77 people. But the interesting thing, and this is where Breivik and Tarrant tie together, Tarrant claimed to have received a blessing from the Knights Templar. Now, that's very interesting. That's, again, that kind of piqued my interest about the original thing when I heard this early on, because we'll get into it slightly in a few minutes. It was a secret order that Breivik previously said he was commander of, but then later claimed it didn't exist. So maybe there's one, maybe he was trying to, you know, escalate his status by claiming he was, you know, commander of the Knights Templar. Or maybe equally as such, someone told him to, you know, to keep it stum about this particularly secret order. It wouldn't be secret anymore. And of course, it's not entirely secret now, the fact that that's come to light. And Tarrant wrote, "I just had brief contact with the Knights Justiciar, I think it is, isn't it? The word Justiciar. I think I pronounced that wrong. Breivik, and received a blessing for my mission after contacting his knights." And of course, a justiciar is an administrator of justice, a regent and deputy presiding over the court of a Norman or early Plantagenet king of England. So that's quite an ancient word. It's a funny word to use. Again, we've got that Knights Templar connection there. And this was an interesting fact I found out, and it got the coup committee going, you know, full scale, full tilt. Strong 10 out of 10 here. Breivik, this is about Breivik. Breivik spent his first year in London and lived at the Norwegian embassy at Belgrave Square, where his dad was a diplomat. Now, that's a bit of a revelation city for you all out there, definitely. That's one I didn't know. And of course, Breivik claimed to have attended a meeting in London in April 2012 to reconstitute the Knights Templar. So that's another connection. But I had no idea, of course, he was at the Norwegian embassy and his dad was a diplomat. That seemed to have got, that's never really been made the news, really. That's got swept under the carpet a bit, that one. The other parallels between Brendan Tarrant and Anders Breivik are the writings on the guns tying to similar insignia seen written on Breivik's bodily apparel, which included marks at Sunter. He also made a manifesto, Breivik, which aped Ted Kaczynski's The Unibomber's Manifesto to some extent. And that's, it's a big subject, which we might, you know, do at length in another podcast. So that's just a few little things there that don't add up. One or two theories. Is there a wider thing? Something at scale here? I've always wondered if the world isn't, you know, ruled by two secret societies, and it's like a religious war. That's just one of my theories, you know, and the secret societies probably actually are running things. But you never know. That's a hint of something a bit more far-reaching and far sinister. But now that's that little subject dusted down and token off. So, you know, don't put that in the shot locker too long. Keep it out at the forefront of your mind and have a good little think about that. But come to your own conclusions and do your own research. Use your own head, your turn instead, as someone once famously sang. And now, speaking about singing, we've got a nice piece of music coming up for you, which I'll hope you'll enjoy. It's tied in slightly to the subject matter of conspiracy. So we'll let this break up the monotony of hearing my voice. Here goes. Here we go, 2, 3, 4. So, listeners, we've come to the drink section of the podcast. Hooray! And I don't mind if I do. Thank you very much. Cheers. Oh, shit, that's gone everywhere. There you are. Fill that one up. And this brings us swiftly on each podcast. Ooh, God, that's going to go over the top. Each podcast is going to be also served with a drink. And appropriately enough, today's drink of the podcast is going to be the Molotov cocktail. And I'm going to do a little history, a bit of history about the Molotov cocktail. And of course, shame, shame, shame on you. And the things you do, readers, if you thought I was actually, and listeners, well, listeners out there, if you thought I was going to tell you how to make an actual Molotov cocktail, naughty, naughty, naughty. No, I'm not going to do that. That would be very, very remiss of me, wouldn't it, as an adult? No, it's a drinks Molotov cocktail. So the Molotov cocktail is also known as, you probably know, as a petrol bomb, and it's a generic name used for a variety of bottle-based improvised incendiary weapons, really. I'm just going to take a sip of my drink. The name was actually coined by the Finns during the Winter War, and that was the conflict when the Soviet Union invaded Finland on the 30th of November 1939. And the name was an insulting reference to Soviet Foreign Minister Vladislav Molotov. So again, my enunciation and pronunciations probably aren't going to be the part, but yeah, it was actually an insulting reference to the Soviet Foreign Minister of the time, and that's how the Molotov cocktail got its name. Although it wasn't the first instance in history when it was actually used. It was used far earlier during the Spanish Civil War, which was between July 1936 and April 1939. Now, here's the bit where you all wanted and probably all been waiting for. I'm actually going to tell you now, all you mixicologists amongst you, and of course, mixicology, you probably know, is somebody who's makes cocktails. Basically, that's a mixicologist. I'm going to tell you how to make your very own Molotov cocktail. So it's best served in a martini glass. I'm not sure that I've got one hand to hand currently. Shaken but not stirred, Mr. Bond. That was a bad impression, but sounded like someone's face been trod on. But anyway, so let's get straight into the ingredients of a Molotov. So you need 45 ml of Kettle One vodka, 37.5 ml of Gifford Parfait Amour liqueur, 15 ml of black Sambuca liqueur, and 15 ml of freshly squeezed lemon juice. And you shake all those ingredients with ice and fine strain into a nice chilled glass. And if you want to add a garnish, you can have a bit of lemon zest as your garnish. And the ingredients represent, now, hang on, I'm saying what they represent here, but you know, the ingredients represent the four liquids used in the weapon. So you've got vodka for your alcohol, the Parfait Amour liqueur, serves as the purple hue of paraffin, lemon juice represents gasoline, and the black Sambuca replaces tar. So there you have it. That was the official drink of the podcast. Next week, or whenever we do this, probably more likely next week, probably when this podcast actually goes out. Alcohol's getting the better of me here. Next podcast, we will have another drink of the podcast. And that I'll be revealing fairly shortly what that actual next subject will be on. So for the time being, enjoy your Molotovs and skull. Now I want to get onto a fairly serious subject after all that tomfoolery and joviality, whoever they are. And it was while I was researching climate scepticism in particular that I became aware of, I wondered why people, two of the most outspoken sort of critics of climate change, particularly Johnny Ball and David Bellamy, why they don't no longer actually appear on television, which I thought that was a bit of an interesting angle to take. They're no longer given a voice that's an opposing voice against, environmentalism, if you like. So it's a one-sided sort of platform, rightly or wrongly, because I'm not sure where I sit on that type of thing. I think sometimes a lot of the weather is in cycles, and I'm a bit sceptical about certain aspects of weather change. I'm not certainly saying that we don't have a massive impact upon the climate, because we do with certain things that we've done, particularly with plastics, in regard to plastic bags. But of course, the irony of all that is that plastic was brought in originally to take away the ivory trade. And of course, Bakelite was one of the first plastic things that was to do away with ivory. So it was brought in for an environmental concern. And now it has gone up, it's diametrically opposed the other way. And it's filling the oceans, which is, you know, to deep regret. So I'm not, you know, I'm not saying for one moment that we're not obviously altering the climate, but I'm sceptical sometimes to what degree we actually are altering the climate, because some of these sort of, you know, propaganda almost, if you like, the videos that are pushed and peddled forth, they almost say that it's, you know, we're going to hell in a handcart, if you like, which I don't think is quite the case, because certain aspects of modern technology have made environmentalism and made great great strides in environmentalism and brought certain issues forward. And it was when I was researching this that I found out that Johnny Ball, who was due to give several talks recently, had found his bookings had been plummeted because he'd had a big harassment campaign. It didn't say who had been harassing him. Various, you know, pornography had been posted up, bearing his name and legion to him and saying he should stay away from children. So it's come some quite horrific stuff, really, which he has reported rightly to the police. But I wondered again which individuals are actually perpetrating this kind of stuff. You know, which individuals are actually going against people. I mean, he was famously booed off the stage not that long ago for saying that cockroach farts, laughably enough, are doing more, you know, are probably as much harm to the environment or doing as you know, as, say, the cars are. So he's making a kind of a comparison. But I'm not sure I agree with that. But at the same time, it's interesting that people like this aren't given a voice. It's marginalised. That's what I think is very interesting. I'm trying to get across the point. And the reason which, you know, piques my interest and makes it sort of more, at least out there, gets the Q-cometer cooking, you know, full spectrum, 10 out of 10. You know, can you hear what the frome is cooking? That type of thing. It certainly, you know, gets my sort of hackles up, if you like, when people like that who are speaking out or actually having an alternative opinion to the mainstream are all of a sudden being harangued and harassed. I think that's quite interesting. I'd like to know who's doing the haranguing and harassment. Is it the establishment? You know, I'm saying it is, but you never know, do you really? So that's an interesting little nugget that I thought I'd just share with you. Because I think some of the stuff that he says I don't agree with, because he was saying, you know, about nuclear power and that type of thing and how safe that is. Well, I strongly disagree with that. So, but other things I could sort of see where he's coming from. And I think that's quite an interesting thing that there isn't a platform for alternative voices. If it's supposed to be, you know, the media, the broadcasting media is supposed to be fair and unbiased, it should equally as such have, you know, views that are diametrically opposed to each other, rightly or wrongly, of course, and let people form their own opinion. But it doesn't seem to always be the case. So that's the interesting fact with that one. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
Good evening and welcome as we go through the rabbit hole.
Yeah, we're back. And I can't believe initially when I started this podcast, I thought it's going to be only for about an hour. And I'd have a job to fill the hour with all the subjects that I'd got at that particular juncture in time. And now I'm going to have we've gone well over the hour. And we're going to have to job to actually, with the other side of the coin, we have a job to squish all these subjects in. So you'll have to beg a pardon, really. Some of these subjects that we're going to cover in the next few minutes are going to be fairly somewhat brief in nature. And I mean, really, a lot of these subjects themselves could have a podcast dedicated to the entirety of that subject, which hopefully in the future we may very well be doing that. But what I'd like to sort of come on to now is something, an article that I picked up in 14 Times, which is, you know, it's a fantastic publication if you're into, you know, your paranormal, you know, your ghosts, your conspiracy theories, dark tourism, Victoriana, you know, you name it, it's in it. So the alternative sort of left field subjects. And it's fantastic. This is a little article that I picked up, a little bit of a nugget of information. And it was a case I was totally unaware of, I said, shame to say. And it was about a British conspiracy theorist who was 39, who sadly died in Poland after telling his mother that he was actually in trouble. And if anything happened to him, to actually investigate. And that got that almost start for a start, it gets the alarm bells ringing. He had bought a Turkish form of Xanax on holiday for £315. And his name was Maxwell Bates Spiers. I'm not sure how you pronounce that one. So apologies for pronunciations if they're not entirely correct. And he said he died while on a visit for a conference to Warsaw in 2016, and his death has been shrouded in mystery. The father of two from Kent died on July the 16th that year, aged 39, at the house of Monica Duval, 50, who let him stay there after they met at the conference. It had previously emerged that before he died, he had told his mother, Vanessa Bates, in a message, "Your boy's in trouble. If anything happens to me, investigate." And those kind of words, they almost set one or two alarm bells ringing already. Especially when you're a conspiracy theorist and you're probably, you know, saying one or two things that could be a bit, you know, too close to the knuckle to ruffle one or two feathers and set the cat amongst the pigeons, if you like. The inquest was held in Kent, Sandwich in Kent. Heard he bought 8 to 10 boxes of the Turkish form of Xanax during a holiday to Cyprus with Miss Duval, and took several of them on the day of his death. A statement from Miss Duval read at the inquest said he had fallen asleep on a sofa after taking the tablets before she saw he had stopped breathing hours later. He then began to vomit. She tried to resuscitate him while waiting for paramedics. She said, "I noticed he had something in his mouth, some remnants of food. So I turned him on to one side and saw gastric fluids pouring out of him, brown liquid, like somewhat tea-coloured. Miss Duval tried resuscitation and paramedics were called, but Mr. Bates Spiers died at the scene," the inquest heard. A summary of the Polish prosecutor's office's inquiry, which was read to the inquest, said he had exchanged numbers with Miss Duval after they attended the Earth Project conference. He was described by the Polish prosecutor's office as a journalist dealing with the topics of conspiracy theories and paranormal phenomena. Ms. Duval agreed shortly after they met to let him stay at her house rather than take his return plane ticket back to Britain. After picking him up from his hotel, she then took him to a doctor's surgery and bought him medication worth more than 1,500 Polish zloty, which is about £315. So a fair bit of medication there. The inquest was then told he had often suffered illness while staying with her, and sometimes he felt weak and sometimes he had problems with focus and attention. She paid for several of the medical appointments during his stay, it was said. At one point, he also returned to England briefly from the end of April until the end of May, then returned to Miss Duval's home. So, yeah, one or two slightly bizarre things there in it. So the inquest heard he had bought the Turkish Xanax equivalent during a holiday with Miss Duval to Cyprus from June the 27th to July the 11th, when he visited a pharmacy and found the drug could be brought without a prescription. So that's obviously some laws that are different to British laws. Mr. Bates Spiers asked Miss Duval to buy the entire stock, about 8 to 10 boxes of the drug, and she filled that request, according to the Polish prosecutor's office. It was said he stopped breathing and a dark brown liquid flowed out of his mouth as Miss Duval and her daughter attempted resuscitation. Ambulance crews arrived after about 10 to 15 minutes and they also tried to save him by reviving him. The Polish prosecutor's office said the death was caused by natural cause and excluded participation of further persons. The inquest, which is scheduled to last 3 days, continues, but again, slightly bizarre circumstances, if ever there was any. Particularly, you know, when you're actually a conspiracy theorist and all of a sudden you say, if anything happens to me, you know, investigate, and then something does happen to him, it sets all the alarm bells ringing, really. And Xanax is often, as far as I'm aware, you know, off the top of my head here we're going, used to treat anxiety and panic disorders. So, It could have caused those symptoms if it had taken in excess, possibly. Yeah, you don't know, do we really? We don't really know that one, but it certainly is an interesting one to. We might, in a future episode, we might certainly go on to that and look at that in further detail, definitely. I feel that's that warrants a bit more of a further investigation than we've currently allowed it, really. So without further ado, we better get on because time's flying by like a rocket off a shoe end and we haven't really got a lot of time to spare. We're going to briefly touch upon a book that I was reading a little while ago, which was dealing with, it's a fantastic book called We Won't Go Back, and it was dealing with the subject of folk horror. And it was by a gentleman whose name currently has escaped me. And I've just come across that name now. It's Howard David Ingham, and it's We Don't Go Back: A Watcher's Guide to Folk Horror. And it's got a fantastic overview. I've read the book now, I think it's 420, 430 odd pages of it. A fantastic overview of the subject, folk horror through films, television programs. It starts off, you know, with some of the classic trio. Films, The Wicker Man, Witchfinder General, Night of the Demons, and it goes all the way through Doctor Who, right up to sort of modern folk horror, French folk horror, takes in Japanese folk horror, it goes the whole gamut. It's a superb book, so I recommend you check that out. And certainly in future issues, I think we'll be very, very tempted to do an overview of hauntology, definitely as a subject. I mean, that's a fairly new sort of subject, hauntology. It's actually the words a portmanteau of haunting and ontology. It was a concept coined by philosopher Jacques Derrida in his 1993 book Spectres of Marx. So it's a fairly new sort of thing, and it's difficult to explain where sort of hauntology starts and folk horror stops, and folk horror starts and hauntology stops, really. I mean, it's taken sort of to sort of mean a kind of almost a late modernity that's sort of concerned almost with retro aesthetics, if you like. So there's the retro aspects of hauntology. Sometimes things can be from your childhood. You know, like bagpuss, sort of disturbing imagery that sort of stays in your mind and you take through to adulthood. And a lot of people often remark upon the public safety awareness films that were famous in the days in the 70s. And I mean, I'm just about old enough to remember some of those being out, you know, first time around. And some of those were certainly, they did the job. They were very, very jarring. I remember the Charlie, you know, always says, don't go with strangers. That particular thing was pretty bizarre, and that was doing the rounds when I was a little kid at school, and that really sort of crept into your bones, that did. So that's that one side of it. And just pretty briefly now, we're going to slide on to another subject, which is to do with hauntology, and it was a fantastic film that was, as I used to say, was on the BBC iPlayer. Sadly, it isn't on the BBC iPlayer, as luck would have it. As soon as we get to do the podcast, it's been taken off. I do believe it's available from certain large online retail stores, not mentioning any names. No pack drills, no names. Names have been changed to protect the innocent. I think you can definitely get it there, and it's called Arcadia, and it was a superb piece of film. It was virtually without narration to a certain extent, and it concerned lots of stock footage, still films. Again, very much about folk customs, folk arts throughout the ages. The cheese rolling, the Abbott's Bromley horn dance, Shrovetide football, Up Elia, which I think is from, I think it's probably in Lerwick, Morris dancing, naturism, Wicca. You know, we could go on and on, and it's fantastic. It gels all those. As in, as if it's kind of a return to the land, a return back to nature. And it kind of drives it, the aspects of birth. Then we go through, you know, middle life, then we go through death, and we go through rebirth again to the beginning of a new sort of juncture, a new epoch of time, if you like. So I really recommend, if you can see that on the iPlayer, if it comes available again, definitely download it and definitely see it. If not, you can certainly be able to buy it, and I really, really recommend that. And I think that's going to be it for this show. I think I've probably gone on too far too much anyway. So we're wrapping it up now. I hope to see you for the next one. Well, a little bit of a hint of what's coming next. Next one's going to be a complete subject on its own, so we're not going to have a potpourri of subjects. It's hopefully going to be probably a lot shorter than this one, because it's gone probably far too long. This is an experimental piece of work. Hopefully the next one's going to gel together a lot better, less segues. And it's going to be on the subject of alien big cats. And when I say alien big cats, I mean the sort of things like Beast of Bodmin, the Beast of Exmoor, Beast of Dartmoor, and we're even going to look at the Beast of Ryburn and the Beast of Twodales. And we're returning again with Joke of the Podcast. We'll have a book review, and we'll have some fantastic piece of music. And while I speak about music, I had forgotten to say that the piece of music that we played today, and many apologies, was The World According to David Icke. Well, that was wonderful Urban Rail Punks Eastfield. And I do believe that, I'll try and find it out for next time. I do believe they're actually in the process of repressing all their original CDs onto record, starting with Keep It Spiky. And I'll try and find the address for that, actually, in a minute or two, and I'll post that up. So I think it's £13 postpaid on a PayPal. And that's definitely worth getting. If that's your bag of mashings, it's definitely worth searching out, getting down and putting that slab of wax on and boogieing away. Definitely, 100%. So I'm just going to read this off the website. It's 20 years since the original Keep It Spiky on CD was released, believe it or not. After having favourable reviews, it sold out and was only available then as part of the Urban Rail Punk collection. It's a totally unplanned to mark such an occasion. The original 10-track Keep It Spiky is now available on 12-inch vinyl for the first time. Released in conjunction with Urinal Vinyl. That's a great, also a very, very good record label. Worth checking out them. There will be a web thing on there. You can check that out. Dirty Old Man Records are limited to a run of 300. We have only half of these at Eastfield HQ and expected to fly out. So it's £10 plus £3 postage and packing if that's your bag of mashings. Just look up www.eastfieldrailpunk.co.uk. Go on there and you can order through the website. If you like that track, you'll like the rest of it, I can assure you. And really, that's about it. So next week, or maybe next month even, which is not that too far away, we should be doing a new podcast all about alien big cats. We'll have Joke of the Podcast back. Please let us know what you thought of it. You know, send in your bouquets or your brickbats, leave us a review, subscribe to us. We'll be available on Castbox, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Anchor as well. So we'll be having all on these particular mediums. I think if it's on Anchor, you can subscribe to us and you'll be doing exclusive content in the future. So that's worth doing. Become our friend. And I hope to be hearing from you. So without further ado, keep it spiky till next time. Love and peace. Ta-ra. Till next time, droogies. Here we are with Joke of the Podcast, take two.
I'm not ready.
Here we are with Joke of the Podcast, take two.
Thank you, Keith. shit.
Thank you, Keith. Here we are with Joke of the Podcast, take two.
I can't do it.
Here we are with Joke of the Podcast, take two.
Thank you, Keith. Which cheese is the favourite of...
Here we are with Joke of the Podcast, take two.
Thank you, Keith. What cheese is a conspiracy theorist's favourite?
I don't know, Jack. What cheese is a conspiracy theorist's favourite?
Illuminati.